Iran warns the U.S. that the window is closing on its deadline for Washington to lift economic sanctions against the Islamic Republic. The White House says it will reconsider the U.S. position on Cuba after former President Donald Trump toughened the sanctions on the country. Also coming up, Mexico overtakes India to become the third worst hit country in terms of coronavirus fatalities. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters at the reigning capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has warned that new U.S. administration must act quickly to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. In an interview with USA Today, Majid Takht-e Ravanchi said the window is closing on Tehran's deadline for Washington to lift its economic sanctions. He said the United States is the one that needs to change course and not Iran. The comments came after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will return to the JCPOA only when Tehran goes back to full compliance with the accord. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran.
With the new U.S. administration taking the helm at the White House, many express optimism that the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will be back on the board. But comments by U.S. officials have raised doubts over the optimism. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will meet its commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, only after Tehran returns to full compliance with the JCPOA. Blinken said the U.S. wants to start meeting its obligations again, but Iran needs to act first. He said Washington would seek to build a longer and stronger accord to address what he called deeply problematic issues. He, however, noted that it will take a long time for the U.S. to return to the deal. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was quick to react, saying it is the United States that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. Zarif recalled it was Washington who violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicine to Iran, and punished countries which abided by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Therefore, it's the U.S. that should take the first step. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran as part of his so-called maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic. Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Tehran says it has lost trust in the Western members of the deal, and it will only revoke its measures after the U.S. removes its sanctions. On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov echoed a similar position, stressing that the United States must remove its sanctions against Iran and comply with the 2015 nuclear deal, as it was Washington that withdrew from the accord. Some experts say Biden has been a warmonger and is not going to return into a pacifist overnight.
I mean, the point being that virtually everything he has done has been imperialist. He's a chief warmonger for the U.S. government. He is not going to turn into a pacifist and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry.
With the Biden administration not showing any practical and real interest in returning to the deal, questions arise as whether he will follow in his predecessor's track and maintain his anti-Iran pressure campaign, or will it put an end to its malign policy against Tehran, as Iran foreign minister put it. Iran, on the other hand, says the window of opportunity is closing very fast.
Now, the White House says it will review former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration's policy on Cuba. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said support for democracy and human rights will be the core base for President Joe Biden's administration's Cuba strategy. After taking office in 2017, Trump took a tough stance against Havana, imposing sanctions on the country. Days before leaving office, Trump returned the Caribbean country to the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, rolling back a détente reached during the former President Barack Obama's tenure. Activist and political commentator Nicholas Ayala says the U.S. relations with Cuba have turned into a partisan matter.
Yeah, a lot of Republican lawmakers are still against this. I think part of it is because they, for the Republicans at least, it's more so a partisan issue where they're always going to be at odds with the Democratic lawmakers. But at the same time, it's an appeal to their base, because a lot of these folks are relying on that hardcore right-wing Cuban-American base, which is completely opposed to any sort of ties whatsoever against or any sort of opening up of the relations between U.S. and Cuba. And I think like you mentioned, it's sort of an old ideology coming from an old time. And I don't think that strategy is going to necessarily work for much longer. And I think that we're going to see that trend continue to shift more in that liberal way, where these Republicans who are using these outdated ideas and these outdated tactics of imperialism won't be able to last much longer in the political world, because these strategies simply aren't working. And it's going to take some serious push, but I think what we're seeing is newer generations of Cuban Americans who are attempting to build different strategies and actually want to open up to Cuba because they want to actually learn more about it for themselves.
Turning to other news now, and Mexico has overtaken India in the number of fatalities from COVID-19, becoming the third country in the world with the highest death toll. Mexico's health ministry reported over 1,500 more deaths on Thursday, raising its toll above 155,000. That is nearly 1,300 more than India's death toll, with a population more than 10 times that of Mexico's. The Latin American country also reported nearly 19,000 new infections, with its overall tally topping 1.8 million. Latin America has been hit hard by the pandemic, with health systems in many countries, including Mexico, almost overwhelmed. Brazil is the worst hit country in the region, with over 9 million confirmed cases and more than 221,000 deaths. The United States faces new challenges as the country registers its first two cases of the more contagious COVID-19 variant, first discovered in South Africa. Health authorities say there is no travel history or connection between the two cases that were found in the state of South Carolina. Several laboratory studies have shown the South African variant reduces vaccine effectiveness and requires higher doses of antibody for treatment. Also, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called for a rapid rollout of COVID-19 vaccines to limit the virus mutation. The developments come as the country's healthcare system is already stretched to the limit. The U.S. is the hardest hit country globally by the pandemic. Its cumulative cases have surpassed 25.7 million, while total fatalities topped 432,000. The United Kingdom's third nationwide coronavirus lockdown is taking its toll. People's livelihoods continue to take a hit, coupled with deteriorating public morale. On top of it all, the government's constant policy U-turns on how to rein in the pandemic has exacerbated Britain's uncertainty and anxiety. Bianca Rahimi has the details.
The UK has used slogans to raise awareness during the pandemic. One of its most popular is Stay Home, Protect the NHS, Save Lives. Some government messaging has been comforting as well as informative, but it's become more and more intense, with TV ads showing people dying and incessant radio ads claiming joggers and people working outdoors are highly likely to have the disease.
Stick to the rules. If you bend the rules, people will die. Stay home, protect the NHS.
The government is now under pressure to pull this ad after Number 10 was condemned by MPs and public health experts for spreading false information. Parents worry they will affect their children. Surely this messaging could be really damaging to vulnerable people and is irresponsible. Telling 5-year-olds if someone bends the rules, people will die seems really inappropriate. We need sensible messaging. They should not be saying people will die. We are heading for a huge mental health crisis in this country. And experts agree. 10 of the UK's top experts in child health say anxiety, self-harm and suicidal thoughts have reached frightening levels among children. Paediatricians are urging the government to reopen schools or risk a calamitous impact on children's mental health. Boris Johnson says he understands the concerns surrounding the mental health of young people, but it all relies on the vaccine.
If we achieve our target of vaccinating everyone in the four most vulnerable groups with their first dose by the 15th of February, and every passing day sees more progress towards that goal, then those groups that have developed immunity from the virus about 3 weeks later, that is by the 8th of March, we hope it will therefore be safe to begin the reopening of schools from Monday, the 8th of March.
Adults themselves are struggling. There has been a surge in people afraid to leave the house. Alcohol consumption has gone up, and helplines say calls regarding domestic abuse have increased many times over.
Health services in the UK say as a result of the pandemic, at least 10 million people are going to need some form of mental health support. And with no real end in sight for the lockdowns and the virus itself, more and more people are losing hope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Now, the United States Department of Defense says the Taliban are not meeting their commitments under last year's deal with Washington. The Pentagon said it's very hard to see a way forward for a negotiated settlement if the Afghan group does not fulfill its obligations. It called on the militant group to, quote, renounce terrorism and stop attacks on Afghan security forces. In February 2020, the U.S. struck an accord with the Taliban without including the Afghan government. Under the agreement, Washington vowed to withdraw all the U.S.-led coalition forces from Afghanistan. In return, the Taliban agreed to not allow extremists to operate from the country and give some security guarantees. Nearly a year after signing the pact, neither the Taliban nor the U.S. have complied with the terms of the agreement. And the Afghan government has accused the Taliban of stalling peace talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. Kabul has also threatened it will intensify attacks on Taliban positions if the militant group does not stop attacking civilians. Amin Alami reports.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot-dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the US, have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Elsewhere, demonstrators in the Lebanese city of Tripoli have set fire to a government building during the fourth night of protests over a strict coronavirus lockdown. Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri said what happened in the city was, quote, organized crime. He added that it was unacceptable that the army did not protect the official buildings. Scores of protesters were injured as security forces used live rounds to disperse the crowd. Officials said rioters threw hand grenades, including at a patrol, injuring at least nine officers. Protesters say the coronavirus lockdown is destroying their livelihoods. More than 250,000 Lebanese have so far been infected. by the virus in a country with a population of around 6 million. The pandemic has also killed 2,500 people. Mariam Saleh says Lebanese politicians who seek power are using people who are dissatisfied with the government to create chaos in Tripoli.
Because the country is divided in a sectarian way, it has always been used as a sectarian card, especially for those who want to go in power. And ironically, or we can say actually sadly, this city has some of the richest men in the world, and it also has people who are very much below poverty line. We have around 57% of the population there below the poverty line, almost 20% in dire socioeconomic conditions. So who led those people to that state of poverty? Those politicians who always wanted to come to that state, to the area of to be a prime minister, especially because, as you know, the political system is divided based on sectarian basis. The prime minister is always a Sunni. It's Tripoli. Most of North Lebanon is mainly a stronghold for Sunni Lebanese. So this is why that is always used now. This is why some people could use and take that, if you may say, that opportunity, or take that state where you have a lot of people who are very much poor and extremely angry at the government, to create that sort of chaos in the city. And this is what even Saad Hariri is talking about today. He spoke about this in his statement, and he said that those people are criminals. But how is he going to deal with this, with all the promises that he has given throughout the years to the people? He and his members of parliament in his bloc, they have given so many promises to the people of Tripoli to try to help them in that, in their economic crises, and nothing has been done yet.
The ancient Silk Road has existed for thousands of years, passing through many different empires, kingdoms, and countries throughout history. The Silk Road enriched the countries it passed through, transporting cultures, religions, languages, and, of course, goods. Last week, Iran was hosting a calligraphy festival in which artists from Silk Road countries put on show their works. Humayun Abidi has attended the closing ceremony.
Iranian cultural figures, artists from different countries, as well as envoys of the foreign states, attended the closing ceremony of the biggest calligraphy event, which was held in Jundi Shapur Library, west of Tehran. Some of the artists also performed calligraphy live, while the audience could watch their expertise. The exhibition aims at convening countries which have olden historical civilizations. Artworks from Silk Road countries, including Pakistan, Egypt, India, Tajikistan, Iraq, Tunisia, Algeria, and Afghanistan, were put on show both virtually and also physically, with limited number of visitors due to the pandemic. The organizers noted that as the works were in different languages, it was not possible to judge them.
Iranian National Commission for UNESCO decided to hold this festival to enhance cultural proximity among countries. We started the preliminary phases since 1.5 years ago. Almost 1,000 works from different countries were received by the Secretariat. As the works were written in different languages, we could not judge them. So we decided to choose the winners randomly.
Veteran calligraphers also noted that calligraphy is a heritage that must always be preserved. Calligraphy works by 203 artists from 30 countries have been showcased in the exhibition, which officially opened on January 20th in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad, Humayun Abidi, Tehran.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Amid ominous chatter about killing legislators or attacking them outside of the U.S. Capitol, thousands of National Guard troops are expected to remain in Washington, D.C. as Trump's trial proceeds in the Senate. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Members of Congress Reportedly Facing Death Threats Ahead of Trump Impeachment Trial. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Federal law enforcement agents are reportedly assessing several menacing statements, including death threats, directed toward congressional lawmakers ahead of the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. That's according to what a U.S. official, who was not authorized to publicly discuss an ongoing investigation and therefore spoke on condition of anonymity, told the Associated Press recently. Though much of the security apparatus around Washington set up after the riot and ahead of Biden's inauguration, it included scores of military checkpoints and hundreds of additional law enforcement personnel, is no longer in place. About 7,000 members of the National Guard will remain to assist federal law enforcement, AP reported recently. The number of troops in D.C. would then continue to decline in the coming weeks. About 5,000 troops are expected to stay in Washington until mid-March. One reason for their prolonged presence is ominous chatter about killing legislators or attacking them outside of the U.S. Capitol, AP noted. Though threats, as well as concerns that armed protesters could return to sack the Capitol anew, prompted the U.S. Capitol Police and other federal law enforcement to insist that thousands of troops remain in the nation's capital as the Senate moves forward with plans for Trump's trial, which is scheduled to begin on February 9th. According to Associated Press, the shocking insurrection at the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob prompted federal officials to rethink security in and around its landmarks, resulting in an unprecedented lockdown for Biden's inauguration. Though the event went off without any problems, an armed protest around the country did not materialize. The threats to lawmakers ahead of Trump's trial exemplified the continued potential for danger. Similar to those intercepted by investigators ahead of Biden's inauguration, the threats that law enforcement agents are tracking vary in specificity and credibility, said the official who had been briefed on the matter. Mainly posted online and in chat groups, the messages have included plots to attack members of Congress during travel to and from the Capitol complex during the trial, according to the official. Law enforcement officials are already starting to plan for the possibility of armed protesters returning to the nation's capital when Trump's Senate trial on a charge of inciting a violent insurrection begins the week of February 8. Inspired by Trump's lies about voter fraud, which were explicitly and tacitly backed by dozens of Republican lawmakers and right-wing media outlets, hundreds of the 45th president's supporters violently invaded the halls of Congress during the certification of President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 election. Although there was, as AP noted, intelligence suggesting the rally would descend into a riot, Capitol Police said they prepared for a free speech demonstration, not an insurrection. Five people, including a Capitol Police officer hit in the head with a fire extinguisher, were killed during the chaotic siege in which law enforcement was overwhelmed. The news outlet reported, more than 130 people have been charged by federal prosecutors for their roles in a riot. In recent weeks, others have been arrested after posting threats against members of Congress. They include a Proud Boys supporter who, authorities said, threatened to deploy three cars full of armed patriots to Washington, threatened harm against Senator Raphael Warnock, and who is accused of stockpiling military-style combat knives and more than 1,000 rifle rounds in his New York home. Texas man was arrested this week for taking part in the riot at the Capitol and for posting violent threats, including a call to assassinate Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This dangerous context has led some to suggest that the Senate's upcoming vote on whether to convict Trump should be concluded via a secret ballot. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich explained that doing so will protect the safety of senators and allow them to vote their conscientious. If Republican senators had integrity and if Trump supporters were peaceful, this couldn't be necessary, Reich added. But they're not, and they're not. So a secret ballot offers a better chance of convicting Trump and ensuring he will never again be president.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here is a piece of advice from Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. The infallible daughter of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Book of Allah, that is the Holy Quran, is the guide for its followers. Listening carefully to it leads to salvation.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, shaped all our tomorrows. The program is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And we were discussing in the previous program about his phase in exile in Najaf and how he was setting out the blueprint for the concept of an Islamic government. And of course, it was not particularly for Iran, although that was the main focus of the address against the Pahlavi regime at the time. But of course, it was an outline for a system which was very badly needed in the vacuum of secularism and atheistic trends which had overrun the Muslim world in the Arab world as well as the Muslim world. So to further proceed with this discussion and this program, we are inviting once again Sayyid Taqi Razavi from the Holy Seminaries here in Qom to speak about the third phase now about the Islamic movement, particularly in Iran. And first of all, salam and a very warm welcome to you, sir.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much for giving us your valuable time. So, Sayyidina, we discussed about the exile aspect, and in those lectures by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, may God bless his soul, he was outlining, you know, exactly the program. And the unique aspect was it's practical. It was a working model in terms of the people's participation in giving it a genuine validity in terms of an Islamic republic on the one level, and on the other level in terms of the concept of the leadership of Walaya, which, as you pointed out before, was nothing new. It was something in the jurisprudence, in the fiqh, but it was from our masumin, from our infallibles, and it was something that had to be brought back into the vacuum, because, as we said before, there were many other schools of thought, but for many reasons, they couldn't come up with this kind of concept, which uniquely Imam Khomeini put the flesh and bones onto. So could you take us now into the third phase, into how this now becomes a reality, how this system really starts coming into being? As you say, there was the cassettes being sent to Iran, and people are now vying for Imam Khomeini to come back to Iran after his exile to get rid of not only the oppressive regime of the Pahlavis, but to replace it with something which gives people progression and prosperity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Yes.
You see, during this time of Imam's exile in Najaf, in other places, there were atrocities taking place in Iran, grand atrocities taking place in Iran, mm-hmm. under the supervision of the Savak.
Of course.
The secret police.
Police, yes. And which was set up by the CIA, of
indeed,
course,
it was set up
by the
CIA.
Americans.
It had very strong links with Mossad. It actually had outhouses in Abadan and Khuzestan.
I think there's a point to be mentioned here. It was Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., mm-hmm. who was the general of the one who took the Kuwait war. It was his father who actually set up the Savak here in Iran.
And consequently, Savak was continuously tracking down those people and those institutions who were keeping links with Imam.
Exactly.
So that kind of want to dismantle any people's revolt in favor of Imam Khomeini was continuously under, you could see some situations where drug dealers were allowed to have a free hand in Iran,
yes.
but religious people did not have
And the other thing was that, of course,
sorry to cut you, but Shah's own sister was a major drug dealer here, Ashraf.
Oh, my
Ashraf
goodness.
Was a very major drug dealer.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, because that is really enlightens us about the nature of the Pahlavi regime.
And there's a palace in
so
in,
she was running a cartel here.
Indeed. There's a palace in his land of palaces of the Shah, which was owned by Ashraf, and it was a den of enjoyment. You know, she had her own cinema hall there. She had her own bars and pubs and everything in that one. I mean, she was an evil woman, a twin sister of Shah. She was both in birth and both in nature.
Right.
So you know, they were totally out to eliminate any line of connection with Imam Khomeini.
Right. Okay.
Throughout, I mean, you've got various ulema who were martyred, who were executed at the hands of Shah Savak people. And not just ulema, you had ordinary people. That prison is kept as a museum now.
Yeah.
Where you go in and you could see all the atrocities, the tools
yes,
of torture.
The political prisoners who were tortured
everything.
To death. Yeah.
So what I'm trying to bring home to you here is this, that Imam Khomeini's supporters were not just left in peace because Imam Khomeini was in exile.
No.
They were continued because the Shah knew whilst Imam Khomeini was abroad, whilst his hopes were that he would die out, he knew that he wasn't dying out.
Yes.
And therefore, all these concepts of Hukumat Islami and all these roles of a Islamic society were being continuously pumped into. And not only were they continuously being pumped into the people through cassettes and things like that, but the younger ulema of the Hauzas who were here, who were continuously being tortured or removed from their abilities to study or whatever. Like, for example, Imam Khamenei, he was taken from Mashhad and he was imprisoned in Iran Sher. You know, they were transported here
and
there.
Absolutely, yes,
So
course.
They were deprived from contact with the people. Yet still, having said that, the brave ulema of that time maintained whatever contact they could. And in relation to that contact, they would use the few minutes between the Salat to tell people what the real Islamic society should be. Whatever they could, they tried their utmost to make sure that the message of a true Islamic society under a leadership of Islam of an Islamic Alim ad-Din.
Shaheed Ayatollah Beheshti had a who was a mastermind in terms of networking in Iran. I mean, he was getting the tapes to places where even the regime couldn't even think of.
Exactly, and you see that's why that's why between the time when Imam Khomeini reached Najaf and in 1978 when Saddam exiled him again, or he removed, he told him to leave.
Yeah, leave Iraq.
Leave Iraq. That Imam Khomeini's period of time over here proved to be both fruitful with relation to contact with Iranians and non-Iranian an Arab ulema.
Yeah.
It also provided that link of the ulema in Iran to keep links with the prominent alim, prominent scholar like Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
Because people would go for ziyarats to Najaf and they would come and kind of grab a message from Imam Khomeini to take to
And bring back to
bring
Iran.
Back. Yeah. So that kind of link of a center point of referral to religious matters, Imam Khomeini was maintaining that.
Yes.
Both in the sense of establishing that intellectual contact and also the economic contact.
Sure.
Because Imam Khomeini, what we discussed last time about the independence of the ulema, that Imam Khomeini, because he was collecting khums, was able to dictate the economy of the Shia community at that time.
Yes.
In the sense that he was providing funds.
Well, this also gives us a unique independence from the regime as well in order to carry out our religious functions.
Indeed, and you could see, again, another concept with the reliant of the faqih. We see that when a faqih wants to be applying God's commands, he has to have both the jurisprudence in his hands and the economy in his hands.
Yes.
You see, most of the fuqaha do not realize that they are natural reliant of faqihs. Why?
Right.
Because they are both defining the jurisdiction through the fact that they are appointing judges, and then they have the economy through the khums. So in naturally they're running an Islamic state.
They are.
But Imam Khomeini articulated that in a physical, applicable manner.
Yes.
And neglected the fact that because these people are just operating from the mosques and from their schools, that they are ignoring their responsibility. Imam Khomeini took his responsibility.
Of course.
He recognized his worth.
Yes.
And this is the subject of a tradition which Mawla Ali says in Najib al-Balagha.
Yes.
He says, he who does not know his worth is ruined. And Imam Khomeini recognized what he was worth.
Nice.
In the sense of the fact that he wanted to do what was Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's command on him.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to digress here, but of course.
Sorry, I should mention the reference for it.
Yes.
It's saying number 149.
149.
In Najib
al-Balagha. I mean, thank you for that, Sayyidina. But the thing is that I don't mean to digress, but of course the success of Hezbollah in Lebanon was also the fact that there is a social duty to the people in terms of the function they carry out, because although we talked about the fact that there is Gnosism and there is the fact that we have to do the disciplining of our souls and all that, but it doesn't go without social duty. I mean, the social responsibility is the the basis on which we practically carry out that gnosis.
Indeed, and you see, particularly you see the role of the ulama who were on Imam Khomeini's line.
Yeah.
They were collecting khums on behalf of Imam Khomeini, and they were distributing to the needy people of, and applying the rules of the khum.
While the Pahlavi regime, as you say, was in affluence and enjoying the luxuries of the public treasury, the people were poor. I mean, there was a horrendous poverty here in Iran.
Indeed they were. And that's where the message got through to people.
Yeah.
And you see, then we just look at the period of his exile, when the Shah puts pressure on it proves now that the enemy of the hatred of Saddam towards Iran was not because he hated Iranians, not because he had anything, but the fact that he became a tool to prevent the Islamic revolution from succeeding later on.
Yeah.
Because Saddam and Shah got together to remove Imam Khomeini from Najaf.
Right.
You know, on the continuous desire that Imam Khomeini does not remain in Iraq to be a pressure on Shah, so he wanted to reduce that pressure. So he tells Imam Khomeini that he must leave.
Right.
Imam Khomeini in 1978, when he's leaving, he first lands in Kuwait, where he decides...
Where he was refused at the border,
he was refused,
I believe,
entry, and thereupon he then went off to France.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is that when Imam Khomeini is deciding to reach France, of course he's also thinking of going to Syria and Libya, the governments over there are put under pressure by Iran not to take Imam Khomeini there.
Right.
And he doesn't. He ends up, and that this again is the destiny that Allah Subhanahu wa Taala wanted to create for the Islamic movement. Because it became an international voice then.
Yeah.
And particularly from France, that the message became even more outburst. The outbursts were even more firmer and want for removal.
I mean, it's a beautiful thing that, you know, when you put this thing together, that you see Imam Khomeini ending up in France, and France became a revolutionary movement for Europe 200 years earlier. And it's almost like, you know, the two things are coming together, that an Islamic revolution, which is going to revolutionize the Muslim world, comes out of the background and the backdrop of a country that was revolutionary for Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fact that, but still, there were people in France who were not happy for Imam Khomeini to be there.
Sure.
Shah was maneuvering more
often. Of course,
often,
I mean, he was getting desperate.
I mean, to extend, there's some documents which have been released which prove that there was an aspiration by Shah that somehow Imam Khomeini should be eliminated in France.
Ah, right. And so that was one of the other motives to send him there. Yeah.
They were unable to do so.
So
and particularly when Imam Khomeini's message became more and more apparent to the Western media and other institutions, sometimes they tried to make the movement look too classic, too pre-time type of thing, that it would not have application in the 20th century.
I think this is another thing. This is very important, that, you know, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala somehow blinds the enemy, because they really underestimated what Imam Khomeini was about, and even his movement at that time was not understood at all, that what exactly was happening from the Nouveau Chateau in outside Paris. They had no clue. I mean, even the Americans were completely bamboozled at what Ayatollah meant and consequences.
The communities, Imam Khomeini worked from different angles.
Yeah.
You know, there's a beautiful story about Christmas when Imam Khomeini was there.
Right.
And Imam Khomeini sends somebody to take a flower and give Christmas greetings to all the neighbors.
My goodness.
You know, so
that's wonderful.
They just didn't understand. You know, for a while they didn't know who this black turban man was, but then suddenly they realized that he has humanly characteristics. Not what, like, the media or people are trying to suggest, that these people are going to topple the Shah or they're going to create a...
And of course he's celebrating the occasion of another great prophet, Jesus, peace be upon him, Son of Mary.
The whole thing, I mean, even now there are a lot of people in the area in Paris who remember Imam Khomeini for this particular gesture of his.
I think there's another important point to be mentioned in the third phase of this very important Islamic movement. We've talked about, you know, the concept of the Walaya. We've talked about the movement of the people. But the most important thing was that the Shah had a very powerful army here in Iran. I mean, it was one of the strongest in the region. And it was a very powerful instrument. And Imam Khomeini very cleverly disarm the army by just simply saying, well, it's only a few officers at the top who need to be dealt with, but the rest of the army, he said, are from the people. Yeah. They're Muslim.
You see, this is where you're kind of drifting into a very important area of the third phase, which is the initiation of the revolution.
Yeah.
Because once Imam Khomeini did, you know, the exile of Imam Khomeini was finishing in the in the late 70s, in 78, 79, when 79 he comes
because,
back in Iran.
I mean, this aspect, you know, I'm pointing out with the army was in the sense that the Shah was relying on this very important tool, and so were the Americans, that they would be able to suppress the people's movement. And we're kind of seeing that 30 years on, you know, even with Egypt, you know, that, you know, the military junta is very difficult to remove. You know, they're very difficult to placate unless you can deal with them right from the outset. And Imam Khomeini does that beautifully.
See,
I mean,
Imam Khomeini did this through this continuous indoctrination of the truth.
That's right.
You see, in the Egyptian arena, you do not have ulema who are guiding the forces even.
I'm thinking particularly of Ayatollah Rafsanjani, you know, although he's, at that time he was Hujjatul Islam Rafsanjani, but at that time he was doing a lot of this kind of work, you know, to get the message across to the ordinary soldier, you know, that, you know,
and you see
about Islam.
These messages which were coming from the cassettes, they were messages of very fierce messages denouncing the Shah. I mean, they were talking about the American serpents, you know, the fact
that
the Americans were eating away at your forces, you know, your forces can't do anything without the authority of an American soldier even.
That's
you know,
right.
Your planes sit waiting for a nut to be delivered from America, and until that nut is delivered, that plane
That's
cannot
right.
take
that,
off. Air Force people can't touch planes without the authority of a senior American pilot. So, you know, everything was coming home to some soldiers. And
they were completely humiliated
and, you know,
by
when
the
Imam
Americans.
Khomeini gave his message in Beit Zahra, he said, you know, you as soldiers, you're part of us.
That's
Do you
right.
want to remain subservient to a
foreign
power?
Army that debases you?
So Imam Khomeini is throughout the time bringing back self-respect.
Yes.
For the Iranian soldiers.
Exactly.
Self-respect and making them realize that when they're opening up, when they open fire on a demonstrator, he's another one of his own Ahle Bayt supporters.
Yes. You know, and he's also saying, are you opening your fire on your own mother and father, on your own parents,
so
your own
you know,
families?
He's bringing this continuous realization, so much so that when the revolution does take place, the very first strong force of support that is given to Imam Khomeini was the Air Force.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, immediately the Air Force gives that allegiance to Imam Khomeini, and you see, you could see that this the continuation of pressure on the society by the society against the Shah was too much for the Shah to handle.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I mean, what really the made you know kind of. Broke the camel's back, straw that
broke the camel's back. Yes,
was the fact that on Ashura, Shah takes a helicopter and flies over the demonstrations, and he sees that there's no empty space there for him to see land, so as to say, you know, it's just waves of people. Shah, what were they shouting?
Because Marbar Shah,
death to Shah.
Shah.
So I mean, what was left for him?
Nothing.
So in reality, Imam Khomeini had instigated this whole movement of animosity towards he who was a puppet of the most powerful nation of the world.
Yeah.
Yet it could not protect its own puppet in its own in the country that it had planted in. Yeah. Then that movement, once Shah did get toppled, America didn't stop.
No.
America didn't stop and say, okay, Shah's gone, let's try and negotiate or see what we can do with this new government. They started instigating anti-revolutionary activities in Iran.
That was the next phase of their plan. Of course, they have a backup, don't they? They always do that.
You see, this was that continuation of that final phase of Imam Khomeini's.
They started to rely on the secular elements to come to the fore, whether they were communist or something
Indeed.
Else. It didn't matter.
No. And they tried to instigate these evil people, not through just Shapur Bakhtiar, but then other the coups that they tried to create in Iran. One of the major coups that they created in Iran was the election of Bani Sadr.
That's right.
That was a very major coup that they were trying to instigate
By
planting an individual who later proved to be the backbone to backbone which enabled Saddam's army to come so far into
Iran.
Iran in 1981.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you could see Imam Khomeini was forced. There was a very major element of foresight in Imam Khomeini's thinking.
Of course.
Of how, I mean, he makes a lot of statements when these corrupt elements were trying to penetrate.
Mm.
Telling people to open up their eyes,
mm,
see the reality of what people
but
are offering.
In a sense, Imam Khomeini was so astute in that situation because, first of all, he kept the army intact, which, of course, he anticipated that the Americans were going to cause all kinds of grievances from north to south of Iran. And because many commanders even now say 30 years on that thanks to Imam Khomeini keeping the army intact, we were able to put the situation under control. And, you know, these things couldn't get out of hand, you know, to show that there was complete chaos in the system.
Indeed. And you see, on the back of freedom of speech,
yeah,
these elements tried to confront.
They were trying to hijack the revolution.
Not only just hijack, but also insult the whole meaning of Islamic society.
Exactly.
And that's why Imam Khomeini left it to the referendum,
where
98.2% who voted in favor of Islamic government.
And there was no say in that.
There were options of Republic of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or just some other terminology
and
where nationalism
comes out and says, no, I want Islamic Jamhuria.
Exactly. You know, so the Islamic
Iran.
Republic,
yeah,
must,
Islamic
be,
Republic.
Must be the concept that we go for.
Because
and that's what people went for.
Yeah.
And this is what these ignorant politicians don't understand,
yeah,
that a Muslim society, as much as how evil you may try to endeavor to make it, there is a heartfelt desire to be a Muslim.
Exactly.
Even in Turkey, with all the corruption and everything, you see, ordinary people want Islamicness for themselves.
That's right, and they vote for Islamic parties inside Turkey.
Exactly. Yeah. So you could see that aspiration to be Islamic society.
Mm.
Imam Khomeini had touched the most depth of this feeling. The whole thing that Imam Khomeini defined for people when he disapproved of Shapur Bakhtiar,
yes,
was that this Shapur Bakhtiar had zero knowledge of Islamic values.
That's right.
How could he possibly be an authority in an Islamic society? Consequently, the only person who could provide some type of Islamic guidance to an Islamic society would be a jurisprudence who has the awareness of how Islamic rules can be interpreted for social necessities.
Yes, yes. And because for the ordinary Muslim, it has to be emphasized, for the ordinary Muslim, particularly in the school of Ahlul Bayt, he needs to give his allegiance to an authority, a marja'i, a taqlid, as they say, an authority to give his allegiance to in order for his salah, for his hummus, for his all his religious duties and rights to be validated in the sight of God.
Well, validated in the sense that to make sure that they're rightfully performed.
Rightfully performed, yes.
In the right manner, rather than the validity of it.
Of course.
One is not saying that
these
people would give some type of stamp of approval
for prayers
performed.
But
just to make sure.
As you quite rightly say, yes.
They're performed in the right order, in the right manner. In the means by which they would be recognized as performed duties.
Exactly.
So, but you see, this is the other point that you're making, which is quite interesting, is that a faqih's responsibility is not just to legitimize or legalize worship.
No.
But in fact, the faqih is defining every act of the individual as a worship
yes,
for God.
Yes, yes, yes.
Even to the extent that, as I said earlier on, he goes to make an earning for his children, he's doing worship.
That's right.
You see,
yes.
And therefore, what becomes even more of a responsibility of worship is he who takes on the authority to rule his community, he should recognize this as a worship. And the only time you recognize it as a worship is when you have God in your sight. And that's why Imam Khomeini said in one of his lectures.
It totally defines politics in a completely different
And that's why Imam Khomeini
status.
Says establishing Islamic hukumat is more important than salat.
Yeah.
He's not announcing kufr here.
No.
What he's saying is he who establishes Islamic hukumat will be an automatic defender of salat.
Exactly.
But he who just does salat does not necessarily have the feeling to establish Islamic government.
Exactly.
You have so many people in lines in Mecca and Medina doing salat, but they don't even have the iota knowledge of how Islamic government should be established. So he who has any minds of establishing Islamic government would have only a mind to establish Islamic government if he sees himself as subservient to the Creator. Subservience to the Creator automatically demands that the individual is one who performs salat, who performs hajj, who gives zakat. So in other words, all aspects of worship are automatically performed by this individual,
exactly,
as one who's striving to establish Islamic government.
And this is where Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, mentions in one speech where he says, well, you know, establishing Islamic government leaves no room for any depraved regime to have any role in such a country. I mean, people like Bakhtiar and all that were automatically unemployed because
Bani
there's
Sadr,
no room for them in such a
Bani
system.
Bani Sadr had zero Islamic values.
Exactly.
I mean, he dresses like a woman to escape from Iran.
My
in
God.
A chadar because
well,
of the
quite rightly so.
Because of the fact that he
quite rightly so
he doesn't recognize in general Islamic rule it's haram for male to wear women's clothes.
Well, there you go. But it's such a humiliating.
No, but
exit.
What I'm trying to say is that these people who have zero or very little knowledge of Islam, how can they possibly advocate to be the heads of Islamic society?
Yeah. But Imam Khomeini makes that clear now.
Imam Khomeini makes that clear. And particularly when he makes it, when a lot of the scholars and students have said that whenever Imam Khomeini talked about anything, he would link that conversation to God.
Exactly.
Everything, you know, if somebody came to him and said, this food is really delicious, he would say, for example, if God did not create the ability for you to taste goodness, you would not have tasted the flavor of this food, for example. You know, he would just take all the conversation to
and
God.
And I think that, just to summarize in the last 30 seconds of the program today, and I thank you, Sayyidina, it was a great contribution there. But in the last 30 seconds, that's what we're talking about at the end of the day, that a proper Islamic republic is really about people being brought near to God.
Indeed.
And in the proper way. And that's what we're talking about.
Indeed. And
it?
Particularly at the hands of He who is able to interpret God's
laws before them in the most competent and in the right manner. So thank you very much, Sayyidina. That was really great today. And in the next sessions, we hope to go in more depth about the impact of what Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has made on the world in terms of the movements that we are now seeing. But that will be discussed, of course, in later programs. But right now, thank you very much for your participation on the program. And thank you, listeners, for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
The last message of the late Imam.
و وصیت من به همه آن است که با یاد خدای متعال به سوی خودشناسی و خودکفایی و استقلال با همه ابعادش به پیش و بی تردید دست خدا با شما. اگر شما
My advice to all is to advance towards self-awareness, self-sufficiency and independence with the remembrance of Almighty God. Without any doubt, His hand is with you if you be with Him and continue with this spirit of cooperation for the advancement of the Islamic country. I pray that all that I see in the noble nation of alertness, intelligence, commitment, devotion, spirit of resistance and courage being employed in the path of Allah shall, by His grace, be transmitted to the successive future generations with increased momentum. With a peaceful mind, a certain heart, a happy soul, and a conscience hopeful for Allah's mercy, I take my leave of all brothers and sisters. I need your prayers, and I beseech Almighty God's pardon and forgiveness for my inadequacies and my faults. I hope the nation too will forgive my shortcomings and failings. Move ahead with power and determination, and know that the departure of one servant shall not leave a scratch on the steel shield that is the nation. Worthier servants of greater stature are in service, and Allah preserves the nation and the oppressed people of the world.
Amen.